Okay, we are now recording, and today is Monday, April 4th, 2011, and this is Brennan Berg at the University of Texas at Austin, and I am interviewing Olympic volleyball player Lori Lewis-Havel over the phone today in order to record her experiences and reflections of the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And Lori, can you first tell us where you are at right now?
I'm in Encino, California.
Okay. And so to start out, we usually just ask all of the Olympic athletes just to share some brief background information just as far as when and where they were born and, you know, their, I guess, sport and athletic experiences that led them to the Olympic Games.
Okay. I was born at Stanford Hospital. December 20th, 1949. I grew up in Westwood, California. I started playing on the beach when I was 14. Actually, I had a coach at Marymount High School who took me under her wing, started training me, and I started playing on the beach. Let's see, how from there, fortunately, I have it written down. I'm much better at writing than... I started playing on the beach. I did take, I was the second winner of the Manhattan Beach Open, which is kind of like the Wimbledon of beach volleyball. But from there, I kind of segued into or had to focus on indoor volleyball. So in 1966, I was on the 66 and 67, the USVBA second place team. In 1967, I was the outstanding high school player in California. I don't know if I was the or one of. 67, I was on the USA World Games team. 67, I was on the USVBA All-American second team. 67, I was also on the US Pan American team. 68, I was on the USVBA National Championship team and the US Olympic team. 71, I was an All-Star Southern California Intercollegiate Athletic Conference. 71-72, first National Collegiate Championship team at UCLA. I did not record all of my tournaments. And then in 97 was named one of the top 25 greatest volleyball players at UCLA.
Congratulations. Well, so around the time of, you know, the 68 games or just the lead up to that, you were still in high school. Is that correct?
I was the baby. I was the youngest.
Oh, okay.
I was in high school. Well, I had graduated from Marymount, entered UCLA, and then had to go into training for the Olympics. So I dropped out for a while. I finished UCLA, but I dropped out.
Oh, okay.
Went into full, you know, we were training at the time 3 hours at night, 3 hours during the day. We trained for months in Long Beach.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went into the people that were chosen or selected right before the games, went up to Tahoe for high altitude training.
Yes.
And then then we hopped the plane to go to Denver to be outfitted and have everybody talk to us and have our gamma globulin shots and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we flew to Mexico City.
Okay. Well, just going back to your early experiences, besides volleyball, were there other sports that you were involved with growing up?
Oh, in grammar school, I loved playing baseball and basketball. I wasn't quite so good at basketball. I've always been kind of a jock. Used to go swimming way out in the ocean with my dad when I was little. Jock in those days was not a good moniker. Today it's not so bad. Tomboy is probably it. Always loved different things like that. Always been part of, I guess, the Sagittarius mindset. There's a half, some Sagittarians are outdoors, some are cerebral. I think I have some of both.
Okay. Well, just now fast forwarding to the 68 games, we'll start, I guess, with the opening and closing ceremonies. Did you march in the 68 opening ceremony? And can you just tell me about your experiences or reflections of either the opening ceremony or the closing ceremony?
I did skip the closing ceremony. I flew home. I had a cold. I was tired. The guy I was had a mad crush on had dated somebody else, and I just went, oh, foo, and went home. I did march in the opening ceremonies. My gosh, it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Avery Brundage at the time who, among others in the International IOC, made an address. There was one track athlete who unfortunately fainted in the middle because we were standing on the field for quite a long time. And the guys were terrific. They just popped her right up and off she went. And then just about the time that the International IOC president was about to say, let the games begin, the people next to me popped up a tarp. And I went, oh. And they said, step under. I thought, okay, I'm not going to argue. It can't hurt. Well, they said the announcement came out, let the games begin, and they released hundreds and hundreds of doves who had been caged for hours. And, of course, they flew right over the athletes and just pelted them from one side of the field to the other, and I'm looking up at this tarp going, thank you. Thank you.
Well, that's definitely a vivid memory. So
it was a vivid memory, trust me.
All right. Well,
it was great. It was wonderful to see all the athletes from all the different countries. It was a magical experience. I kept waiting for the sky to open up and bells to ring.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't, but I kept waiting for it.
That's great to hear. okay, so. While you were there, what were your accommodations like there in Mexico City? Can you remember, for instance, what floor, you know, you stayed on in the village, or who did you room with, or just what the room layout was?
I can remember that we stayed in a brand new, probably five-story, I'd have to check my notes because I actually went back and checked it, apartment buildings. They were new. They were beautiful. I mean, nice accommodations, no heat in there, which was considering you're 7,000 feet up, and it was October, it was getting chilly. The other thing was that of course, athletes are training how many times a day and changing clothes and all that, so you had laundry. Everyone was hanging their jerseys over the side to dry it. Everywhere you looked, you could see, depending on what time of the day and how many sets of clothes they had. Nobody had enough, obviously, for 2 weeks or whatever. So there was always, you could tell who lived where. We lived in, I don't know, roughly I would say the fourth or fifth floor of the apartment building. They were guarded by little uniformed female Mexican guards who kind of were like Gestapo. They smiled now and then. But they were reacting to, and I think the government down there was reacting to, Don Fraser's book from the Australian Olympics on all the hanky-panky that went on. So the women were kept strictly apart from the men. The doctors even had to kind of beg to get in by these little kind of Gestapo kind of guards.
Mm.
My roommate was Mickey McFadden, whom I met up with not long ago. We've stayed friends for years, as have a number of us on the team. When you live and play together for months and months at a time through ups and downs and ins and outs, you develop a bond.
Sure.
Mickey and I have always gotten along. We used to, in Tahoe, I used to slather her hands every night with lard and put gloves on them. And that's because we all, if you see volleyball players who are really in intensive training and they have their hands on the leather ball constantly, they lose the oil in their fingers. They start cracking and bleeding.
Hmm.
So I would slather her hands in lard every night in Tahoe. And we had kind of a great time once we got down there. We weren't roommates two in a room down there. It was like four or five in a room. And we were all pretty much together.
Okay. So Was there anyone, just looking back, that you know you just remember becoming particularly close to on the
Mickey
team?
Mickey and I were close then. I was the youngest. She was the next youngest. Mary Perry was a friend of mine and continues to be a friend. She's phenomenal. Was the jokester of the group. Managed to give not everyone, but most of the people nicknames. kept everyone laughing. Was just phenomenal. But then again, I've stayed in touch with or close to a lot of them. A few years went by before we all got back together about 4 or 5 years ago.
Oh, that's great.
We've only lost one player.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, during the 68 games, you know, it's the middle of the Cold War. What are some of your memories of the athletes from the Soviet bloc?
I find that question fascinating. The reason being is, at the time, we were tracking all sorts of different sports, etc. And the story goes, and I don't know if it's accurate, there were two, and I used to read about them in track meet, two Russian athletes, Tamara Press and Irana Press, supposedly. One was a male taking female hormones, one was a female taking male hormones. I think they put the shot or something like that. They were sizable athletes. And then when it was announced that we would all have to have chromosome tests, which had just been invented by, I think, Bioscience, their mother got sick and they couldn't show up. We all kind of were amused at that, whether or not it was true. The fact that the Soviets showed up really was not it was nothing that at least the people I was around were very much concerned with. In fact, I have a picture of Mary Perry and myself and the Russian volleyball coaches. We were pretending to pull his beard. I mean, we stopped, and there was a lot of gesturing because you would go to the international club at night, and of course you got a gazillion different languages. So you didn't necessarily speak the other language, but people could gesture, and they had papers there from all over the world. You'd find the one that fit you, and you'd go from there. But in between, you'd be talking or gesturing to other athletes, depending on whether they spoke English or, I have to say, at least me, a lazy American, did not speak Russian and a few other languages. So it was kind of a wonderful experience, kind of let down. People were observing other people, culture. Mm-hmm. I recall I was hanging out at the time with bunch of the basketball players, American, and they were all eyeing the Swedish athletes, who were very attractive. And they came in, and they leaned over to get a paper, and they had sleeveless dresses on. And of course, they had big tufts of hair under their arms because that's their culture. And the basketball guys all went, ew, turned around and walked away. It was kind of an interesting experience because everybody was there. Everybody was on an equal ground. There was nobody who was better, superior, or anything else. It was just enjoying all the athletes there. And, of course, from the time you hit ground in the village, you wanted to trade pins with all the other athletes. I ended up, I forget who got in a week before us, but they got the really good corner of the market on pins. We were given, the U.S. was given pins as well to trade. And so you're trading as fast as you can, which is a wonderful way, especially if you can't speak the language, to get to know other people. Mm-hmm. I actually ended up trading my U.S. uniform for a West German uniform.
Wow.
So there was a wonderful feeling of camaraderie, and perhaps in my mind at least, I felt very safe with the Gestapo at the apartment houses. The village itself was very well guarded, naively, of course, because the Olympics a few years later were not so safe, but we had read and been told about the riots in Mexico because our Olympics were in October. They started, I think, October 12th, which was very late. And we knew there was rioting going on. I never knew it was called the however one pronounced, Teotihuacan massacre, though. We heard bits and pieces about what was going on, but I think we all felt pretty safe.
Okay. So you've already alluded to this, but just going back to it, what were some of the training methods you used to prepare for the altitude of Mexico City? And, I mean, did you feel like any of that preparation really paid off? Did that pay off in Mexico City when you got there?
Yes, yes. We spent, I don't know if it was a month or two, in a little town just outside of Tahoe. Richardson, I think, was the name of it. We stayed in a kind of a log cabin lodge. The volleyball team did. Some guys were in trailers down the road. We were there for about a month. We all railed at our coach who got us up there the first day from Long Beach at sea level and said, we'll take a little jog walk. Well, that turned out to be a four-hour ordeal. Fortunately, we're all in pretty good shape. And then we worked out up there regularly, you know, 3 hours in the morning and then wind sprints and two miles of jogging, running, and then 3 hours at night and 100 sit-ups. And we didn't jog at night. We jogged after the morning practice.
Hmm.
So by the time we got down there, the altitude didn't bother us.
Okay.
We were also young and in shape.
Was it just the volleyball team that was at that particular location, or were other teams there?
We were, gymnastic team. Kathy Rigby et al., and I forget the name of the coach. It's escaping me, but I have it written down. I can see her face. They stayed there also. And the rest of the teams were kind of billeted around the area. So we still got to see people.
Oh, okay.
And we, you know, one of the memories I have of that is we had this kind of a similar type of dinner every night. Very nice fellow who made our dinner, wore a little knit cap. I don't know what his name is or was. Don't know that much about him, but he made Jell-O every night. And this was before Jigglers. Oh, my goodness. One night after about weeks and weeks of Jell-O, we actually took a few pieces and threw them against the wall, and they bounced back. And we went, oh, okay.
Oh, that's a pretty good story. All right, moving on, and this is a really, I guess, broad question that you can discuss just whatever stands out to you, but for you personally, what was the most meaningful part of participating in the 68 games in Mexico City?
You know, it's interesting because I read what scholars say and everything else. I've always felt that, not that it was the most culturally significant, but on the way in, it was, I think, Reno, John Carlos won a jackpot for me in a one-armed bandit. I, of course, was 18, underage, but that's okay. We met and were around all these different people. So it was kind of like, it was thrilling to see these people. Jim Ryan, who had broken the minute mile, sorry, there's a siren going by. The athletes who were phenomenal, whom I'd followed for, you know, so long. And so just being there and being able to watch them, to me, was phenomenal. You had, Dick Fosbury, who created the Fosbury Flop. You had Jim Ryan. You had Mark Spitz. You had Debbie Meyer, who everybody was enamored of. It was a phenomenal assortment of athletes.
Mm.
Tommy Smith. I mean, before even you got to the competition, just being around all of them was phenomenal.
Okay. Well, I know we've already brought up several of these different issues, and as you just said, I mean, the 68 games were significant for so many different reasons that we still look back on. So again, whether it was the Cold War, the massacre of protesters prior to the games, but also the high altitude, the testing for performance-enhancing drugs, and just the first games in, you know, South America, Latin America, and of course, Smith and Carlos is a, you know, Black Power salute.
That was phenomenal, yeah.
What, you know, how aware were you of all this, all these issues around you, and how did that affect your whole experience there in the Olympics?
In terms of the Soviet bloc being there, that was just kind of one of the athletes.
Mm-hmm.
We were very aware of Smith and Carlos. Even more aware of the long jump. Who was the... I didn't bring that note out. Anyway, the 22-inch long jump where he jumped and then knelt down and cried. And it was 22 years before that record was broken. Beeman, Bob Beeman.
Yes.
That was phenomenal. There was so much that was going on that we were aware of it. The fact that you keep saying it was the first Olympics that people were doped or tested for doping. It was the first Olympics that they ever had a chromosome test.
Mm.
And we were warned of that. We were warned one night that when we get a summons, you show up or you're out of the games. So I showed up one day, I'm thinking, okay, chromosome test, my goodness. And so here's this little Mexican doctor, very nice, scraping the inside of my mouth with a tongue depressor. And I'm saying, what is it you're looking for? What are you doing? He says, don't worry, you'll pass. And I thought, okay, whatever. And I have a receipt now signed by Prince somebody who was in charge of those games that says in three languages I passed the sex test. Doesn't say what sex I am. Of course, they only tested women, but a few years later, there was a Polish runner who came up with an odd number of chromosomes, and they refused to let her compete, which outraged me. I mean, classify her one or another, but don't, you know, the fact that her chromosome count is a little different should not eliminate her from competing. And this goes back to what I was saying about Tamara and Irana Press. That to us was just kind of amazing. Yes, we had a girl on the team who was tested for drugs. We had a 9 o'clock match, I forget against whom, and at 11 o'clock they scooped up Nina Jorgensen and said, okay, you're being tested for drugs. Well, when you go into the heat of competition, going to the bathroom is not the highest thing on your body's priority list. It kind of shoves it to the back. So they kept her at the stadium for a couple of hours, and of course she had to have two witnesses watching you. And then finally they took her back to the apartment, hoping it would help her. And finally around midnight, I guess, she was able to give them a specimen. But it was funny things like that. There were all sorts of things. It becomes a tableau where one goes into another. You know, going to the refectory at night for dinner, which was kind of a phenomenal experience, a giant cafeteria where supposedly they flew food in for us every night. And people would come in with gold medals around their necks. And there was a chap one night, George Woods, who came in. He had this great coat hanger, and I thought, he says, anybody want it off of his suit coat? And I thought, what a great coat hanger. I could put pants and, you know, I could put a whole bunch of stuff on it because it's really well. So I took it home. There's nothing in my closet that would fit on it short of a sheet. The thing was huge. I mean, it was just monstrous. Then I started looking around at, you know, when we flew down from Denver to Mexico City. I think it was Jay Sylvester was on the plane. I mean, we were all together. We'd received gamma globulin shots for hepatitis, and Jesse Owens had spoken to all of us about behavior and how to represent the United States. And there is Jay Sylvester sitting in this seat, actually three seats. They gave him one for his body and one for each arm. The guy was huge. The basketball players. There was one night I was hanging out with a friend named Ken Spain. even though I had a crush on somebody else. But we became good pals. So Ken and I went to see some game, and we went back to eat, and he goes, "Oh my gosh, I made a date with one of the swimmers." And he goes, "I can't make the date." And I said, "What's the matter with you?" And he goes, I have a match." I said, "Well, that would be a good reason." So he says, "You got to get a note to her." I said, "Okay, so tell me what her name is and what floor she's on, and I'll get a note to her." So I left the note, and we went to the refectory for dinner. And we walked in, and we come out, and it had rained just torrentially. But meanwhile, when we were at dinner, the little swimmer, who was only about 5 feet tall, and of course, or less, and I'm about 5'11", so the three of us walk out, and it's rained torrentially, and it's all sand, and it's so there's big puddles, huge puddles. And he says, "Okay, Lori, you put your arm around one side," and he said to the swimmer, "You put your arm around my other neck to the other side, and I'll carry you across." And I'm very embarrassed, going, "Oh my gosh, he's going to list my way. He's, you know, I'm huge, she's tiny." And he took us both, and he walked us right across this huge puddle where 10, 15 people were standing behind us on the stairs trying to figure out how to get across. His shoes were so tall. He never even got his shoes wet. It never went above the soles of his shoes. And I looked at him, I said, "What size shoe do you wear?" Well, many of them, most of them, had custom size shoes. So it was kind of interesting, you know?
Yeah.
There were, I mean, all sorts of things. Daily, you would see things. They had a brand new tartan track in the middle of the village for people to train on. And so there were always people out there training and running, whatever they were doing. We trained off-site. Every day there was something different, something, you know, going on.
Mm. Oh, I'll bet.
It was never dull. It was never boring.
Oh, sure. Earlier you said, in regards to just all the issues that were going on around those games, but when it came to the Black Power Salute, you said everyone was really aware of that. Can you go into more detail about that, of just what that was like being, I guess, around such a...
Everyone knew about it, and basically we were all on Carlos and Smith's side. We were all rooting for them. All of a sudden, though, they weren't around anymore. Mm-hmm. They were whisked off. Carlos, I think, wound up down in... He had a terrible time after that. Both of them did.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it at an Olympic reunion we had a year and a half ago, where all the athletes from all the Olympics gathered in San Jose. And we actually viewed statues to Carlos and Smith the next day, and I ended up riding in a parade at Disneyland with Smith in 84 with a Mickey Mouse gold medal around our necks, which was kind of humorous, but anyway. We were very aware that it happened. We were rooting for them. We had no idea what was going on behind the scenes with them.
Hmm.
The fact that I understand later from documentaries, they were whisked away pretty quickly. The fact that they had great difficulty getting jobs for years, my understanding is Carlos's wife, I think, committed suicide, that they had such a rough road. That I think a lot of the track guys helped them out, did the best they could to help them. And now, of course, you have a memorial to them at San Jose State where they trained.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were very aware that it happened. It was the talk of the village. But at the same time, the athletes were immersed in, this is, you know, the apogee of 5 years, 4 years, 8 years worth of work. So, okay, that's going on, but this is my focus. And people were terribly focused.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to the village, the two nights before the opening ceremonies, there was a movie for all the athletes in, I don't know what room they called it, and we all showed up, and it was Mary Poppins. And, of course, the guys are snickering, and everybody's going, yeah. Well, everybody showed up the next night because they had another movie, and it was the Tokyo Olympiad. And it was kind of fascinating because I think half the people in the room walked out about a foot off the floor after that documentary. They were just pumped. But this, everybody was so tight, so taut, so focused, so into what they were doing, that and into what was happening, that, yes, there were distractions, but it's not a distraction, as you would say in retrospect, where, oh, my gosh, this happened. They're going, oh, my gosh, yeah, everybody's, did you hear, did you see, did you do? But we have a match now. Mm-hmm. That's it. Everybody, I remember sitting in a sauna with Maxine Mitchell, the fencer, and we talked about politics in her sport compared to politics in my sport. Well, all the sports have politics, and they all have the same kind of problems, the same kind of dedication to people involved and the athletes involved. Sitting down and talking with other athletes and finding out what hurdles they went over, what hurdles they went through, what the politics were in their sport, what was going on there. This was all, it was all there, but you had to keep your main focus was on your competition.
Okay, well, yeah, that's certainly understandable. So once you got through the Olympics, and returned home, what kind of reception did you get, and what happened to you after the games? Did you have any downtime, or did you go directly back to competing in volleyball or in going back to school?
I competed for a short time, and then I retired. I went back to UCLA. Well, I took some classes at a junior college till I hit the quarter system right again. I went back to UCLA, played for UCLA. And, yes, that's when we won our first NCAA championships, and we went to Lawrence, Kansas, and Florida, and had a great time. I decided to retire because I was the youngest, and many were like, I was 18, many were 24 or older, and Jane Ward was older than that, and a few others, but the average was, I think, 6 years to get a bachelor's degree, and I was getting bored of being in school a little bit and then training and then being in school a little bit, so I wanted to finish school.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to UCLA. And at that point, I wasn't, you know, it was like I had, you train and then you're in training for whatever competition, Pan Am Games, World Games. I was supposed to have gone to Puerto Rico one weekend for an international match. I went to the airport four or five times. Somehow it never happened. So after that, it's kind of like, I think I just want to come down, settle down, get on with my life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, just having had all these years to reflect on your Olympic experience, what's one piece of advice you would give today's Olympic hopefuls?
Go for it with everything you've got, and then enjoy and relish every single minute.
Hmm. That's good advice. Well, what does the creation and preservation of the 68 U.S. Olympic team legacy mean to you? And you've certainly done a great job of documenting it yourself and your own experiences. So what would you like to see just come out of this oral history project, and what would you like the legacy of the 68 team to be?
I think I'd like the legacy of the 68 team to be what it was, which was stunning in many facets. Because it was then, it was for 22 years with Bob Beamans, with some of the milers, with the pentathlon, the decathlon, so many things that went on that were phenomenal there, with Smith and Carlos, with the fact that it was high altitude and everybody poo-pooed it. We knew that going in. It was a phenomenal experience all the way around, and I think it's something that should be preserved for posterity. I teach, after 38 years in the corporate world and writing and everything, At 57, I went back to school and got a degree or credential to teach special ed. I teach middle school, the wild hormone hype tweens. And one of the things I do, both for history classes and English, is I teach Maya Angelou, who gave, when we were at the reunion, she had done a poem for the athletes in Beijing called Amazement Awaits. It's a DVD. And I use that in conjunction with her poem to teach poetry. But then I also will use it as a focus on the Olympics. And they gave us a DVD of the 68 Olympics, which starts with the opening ceremonies and has the Smith-Carlos raised fist to teach some of these kids what it was like then, why it was controversial. They still don't quite get it because life has changed so much. But it was a huge impact in a lot of ways, and many people were critical, and many people this and that. But it was a phenomenal experience all the way around.
Oh, I'm sure. Well,
a phenomenal group of athletes and people.
Oh, absolutely. Are there any other, thoughts you would like to share just as part of this project that we have not covered, or anything that really stands out to you?
No. You know, the other thing was, it was great fun. We had little jackets that had USA insignias on it. And we would go into town, and there would be people from the U.S. anywhere. And they would greet you. Say hello, where are you from, which coast, how you doing, how's your competition going? And it was great. It was a feeling of universality, which was incredible, even in a foreign country. It was phenomenal. In fact, one of the highlights for me, I know this sounds a little parochial, but my eighth grade gym coach came down there, and I was able to get her in with her husband and give her a tour of the village. And that was just phenomenal. It was great fun.
Yeah. Well, this is a lot of great material you've supplied us with. But yeah, if there's not anything else you want to share with us, we can go ahead and just end the recording here, if that works for you.
That sounds good.
Okay, I'll stop the recording right now.